Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Thanks to an amazing $5 million endowment announced just days ago, the transformation of Greenwich Library from a traditional library into a comprehensive cultural and educational center will pick up where Connecticut's most visited library left off with its recent reimagined renovation project. So we're going to call on the library director to expand on this news and to let patrons and the public know what's in store for the future. Then we're going to welcome the entire leadership team from Impact Fairfield County. We're going to talk about their second impactful conversation of this grant year on the topic of getting space for mental wellness and exploring how peer pressure, isolation, and attachment to technology are shaping children, families, and local communities. And we're going to let you know how to get involved in or support future activities. And we'll wrap things up with the Connecticut Data Collaborative. The agency just released an important report on how new federal DOT policy would disadvantage Connecticut, especially our urban centers. So we're going to unpack that as well as examining highlights from their latest annual report. Data was never so interesting or topical. But first, we want to remind you that Connoisseur Media and our radio stations are partnering with the Bridgeport Regional Business Council and numerous other support and chamber organizations to bring you the Engage and Grow Expo, a dynamic gathering of leaders, innovators, and businesses dedicated to driving growth and making a difference in our community. It's all happening March 20th at Bridgeport's Total Mortgage Arena from 1 to 5 p.m. The expo is a unique opportunity to connect with local business owners, entrepreneurs, and professionals eager to exchange ideas, discover new opportunities, and learn from industry experts. This event is designed to be an unmissable opportunity for professionals looking to elevate their business strategies and expand their networks. So don't wait. Register today by visiting engagegrow.brbc.org. Well, I'm so pleased to open the show with a brand new acquaintance here on the award-winning For the People, but also a kindred spirit, not just a lover of libraries, but the director of Connecticut's most visited library, the Greenwich Library. Joe Williams is on the line with us, and in chatting before we went on the air, we both discovered that we shared the experience of working in our college libraries when we were younger folks, and that love of libraries and the importance of them in our communities and societies is no less important today, perhaps even more so. And it was thrilling to hear about the $5 million endowment to support their signature series programming that was announced formally a few days ago. So we're going to talk about that and everything folks need to know about the Greenwich Library, from where it's come and the direction you're hoping to take it, Joe. So welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. You know, and it was really nice hearing that you had worked at libraries in college, you know, and I had mentioned to you that you sounded much more like a diligent work study student than myself. I worked in the interlibrary loan department, and I would always have to run up and get material, but then I get distracted by the books and I end up sitting in the stacks and reading the books, and then they would have to send out people to go find me.
Well, if you,
but
you,
I've
you
improved can, it.
Yeah, you can't be a good library worker without knowing the stock. That's what I say.
So, yeah, that's right. I was sampling the stock
there
too
you
much.
Go. Yes. Then at least it was at a library. So
yeah, yeah.
Very good. Well, and look how far you've come. I mean, let's talk about your beginnings with Connecticut's most visited library. When did you arrive in Greenwich?
I started in Greenwich as the deputy director of the library in 2014, and I was promoted to director in effective January of 2023. So I'm within my third year as the director now.
And I can imagine never having met you, I could still imagine the look on your face when you first got word from the Lynn and Richard Pasculano organization regarding this endowment. Let's start by talking about that and the lead up to it.
Sure. So this is, you know, the news is brought to me by Lisa Mandel. She is our development director. And she had, you know, she had really been, she interfaced a lot with Lynn and Richard for quite a while, who had approached her because they were really impressed with the quality of the speakers we were bringing in the Signature Series. So I, you know, I'll backtrack a little bit on that. So before we launched the Signature Series, that came about really because of what we did in our renovations. And we ended up doing a major renovation at the library from went right through COVID time, so 2019 through 2021. And we launched this new series, and we did a whole new renovated our auditorium. We converted into a theater. And what we wanted to do was we wanted to make a commitment to the community to be able to offer high-level thought leaders and speakers that the community can come in to and, you know, learn about their thoughts and experiences, because it really does further our mission as a library on its cultural and educational side. Mm-hmm. So we end up launching those, and it, you know, the quality of the speakers was such that they approached us and they said, this is something that, you know, that they felt really strongly about making sure that the community would have perpetual access to. And they, you know, and they approached us about it, and we were just like, we were thrilled about it, because this means that we can carry on this series in perpetuity, but also it allows, it kind of loosens up other areas of how we budget for our program, so it affects the entire suite of everything that we do here in terms of our public programming.
Sure. Bringing in the people for a one-off experience or opportunity that feeds their interest, it really, literally and figuratively, could open the door to a new lifelong relationship with an organization like Greenwich Library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's important, because, you know, it just, like, on the community side, just being able to bring people in here and they understand our role in the community as being part of that ecosystem, which really builds civic dialogue. It really creates unifying bonds amid the community, and especially in, like, in an era like we are today, where there's just so many divisions, you know, the role of the library is to help foster that sense and to counter that sense of division, because we're really all in this together.
And the Pasculanos are no strangers to library patronage. Greenwich is not the first library that they have supported.
No. They've also supported other libraries, including, I think, a major gift to the New York Public Library as well.
So this was the next step. So you publicly announced this on February 20th at an event featuring Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and author Thomas Friedman.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so we had Tom Friedman was the launch, and we rebranded the series just from Signature Series to the Lynn and Richard Pasculano Signature Series. And it was like, it was nice, because it was really, the announcement was really well received by those who were in attendance, you know, a lot of oohs and, you know, ahs types of things, because it is, since we, in the last, for the last 30 years, you know, this is the largest endowment that we received. Our last major endowment was our Peterson Endowment in the late 1990s. So this is incredibly meaningful for us.
So this endowment furthered your ability to continue your transformation. Recently, this Reimagine renovation project, as you briefly mentioned, was kind of, you know, reaching its last chapter stage. Is that did that involve both that physical transformation of the theater wing, as well as new features or programs or hardware for the public good in other places or throughout the entire library?
Oh, absolutely. We did the entire library, so and we built new spaces. Just as some of the things that we did there that have been very well received is that we've created an innovation lab that features, you know, some of the latest technology. Just, you know, we started off with 3D printers, and we have laser cutters and other equipment, you know, that can do augmented and virtual types of reality. And that's really taken a life of its own, you know, not just for like kids to come down and experience, but also like a lot of adults use the lab too for fabrication. We've had entrepreneurs come down to prototype materials in that lab. That's been a wonderful addition for us, and we're going to be highlighting a lot on that at our, I think it's March 22nd, our innovation experience. We're going to be at the whole library. We're going to be devoting different areas and spaces to new technologies. We're going to have drones flying through the library. We're going to have generative AI so people can like do things for like swag bags. So that's going to be a fun day for us. And that's just, you know, built out of one of those spaces that we created. Oh, and I think that is actually March 29th. March 22nd. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Anyway, yeah, so we got that. We had that space. We also built the Marx Family Black Box Theater. And that's our mid-level space with a capacity of around 100, and that's a great space. It's a multi-purpose room that we use for different author programming, story times, all sorts of programs for that. So we were able to build that space as well. And we also, you know, kind of rigged, you know, the whole library, reviving our technology infrastructure, so we have a greater use. We've opened up space so that we can have people in the community come down and use the space, and we've seen a very strong response to that. So it's so year over year since the pandemic, we've seen increases in our gate count, and we're approaching about 500,000 people a year who come down and use the facility. I've been particularly impressed with the number of young adults and students who are now using the facility of the main library, especially during midterms and finals. They flock down here. That it's a bit of a thing with them. And it's great that to see like younger people coming in and just using this shared public space.
Hmm. So building on that innovation theme, you not only have your extremely talented and informed library associates, but you guys were innovative enough to bring in an innovator in residence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our current innovator in residence is Walker Wind. And, you know, this is one of the things that we had been wanting to do for a while, because we have a lot of in-house talent, you know, that can do things to a certain degree. And we have people that are very good, like some people are very good at coding. We're certainly very good at using laser cutters and things like that. But sometimes what you need is you want to have a specialized person who has a lot of specific knowledge to share with the community that we may not have. So in this case, you know, you would have somebody who might be very knowledgeable about robotics or sustainability issues. And I know Walker is particularly cognizant and knowledgeable about that, being that he's an engineer himself. And also we have you know, he's also very good at product breakdown. I found this really fascinating that one of his types of projects is to break down like a household piece of equipment, like say like it's a washing machine or something like that. And I think that's one of the items that he has worked on. You take a washing machine, you break it down to its different parts, and then you kind of figure out the economic cost of each of those parts and how, you know, how much is the cost of that washing machine. So he kind of looks into the economics of that. Now, he's going to be working on, for the innovation experience, a Rube Goldberg machine. And I'm not quite sure what it's going to be doing yet. I don't know if it's going to be turning a page of a book or not. But they'll be showing that off at the experience. So, yeah, that's definitely an interesting initiative that we've been doing and been pretty successful so far with it.
Oh, that's great. So as I mentioned before we picked up in both patronizing and then eventually working with the Silas Bronson Library back in the early to mid 70s, Waterbury had a robust network of library branches, and perhaps they're not referred to in that way anymore, but Greenwich Library is part of a small network that also includes Byram, Schubert, and Coscob, right?
That's correct. Yeah, no, those are, we still call them branches. So we have two smaller libraries, Coscob and Byram. They serve different areas of the town. Greenwich also has a separate independent library, the Perrott Library, which serves Old Greenwich. So those are very well received by those different neighborhoods in the community. They feel very much attached to the people who live there. You know, my thought about the role of branch libraries is that they're really excellent for neighborhood development and fostering that sense of neighborliness and community within these different parts of the town. So currently, like the Coscob branch is undergoing an expansion as well as a renovation. So if you headed over to Coscob and you saw what's going on, you can see that they've extended out the building a little bit so that they can build a larger programming room and we can build a larger children's area. And that's been well received by the community. And we will have that project done probably by the end of the summer.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I know from my youth, depending on which branch you went to, and we were always encouraged in school to visit all of them, not just the downtown, the main event, so to speak. Do any of the other libraries in your purview have specific features, or do they house specific activities or collections or you know, things that make them a unique and attractive destination aside from the Greenwich Library itself?
Yeah, they do. They have I wouldn't say that there's anything thematic about them so much, but they do have their own unique offerings. Some of it has to do simply with community type events. I know that the Coscob Open House is a very popular event for that part of town. And then Byram has its tree lighting ceremony as part of like one of their community events. But they also have a bit of a local history collection for Byram Schubert. So they have that as well. Plus, they also have an interesting collection. We've actually put our French book collections at Byram because of the more of the demand on that side of town. So I don't know why that is, but you know, we kind of respond to that. And they also offer different types of programs. Like for example, at Coscob, their programming, which has been curtailed lately because of their renovation, has focused a lot on children. But they've also done a lot of other programs, like if they really do a lot of programming at Coscob. Byram does a lot more on the, I would say, like on the international flavor types of programs as well. But they're both like fun, you know, types of community spaces that you can go into and be welcome. And another interesting thing about those branches is that both of them are located directly across from elementary schools.
Mm.
So there's a lot of interfacing between the students at the New Lebanon School and the Koskob School with those libraries. And that's something that you don't have at the main library, because there really isn't. The closest elementary school, I think, to the main library is Julian Curtis. And that's, you know, that's a bit of way.
Sure. Well, that's great. It's been wonderful to have a conversation with you, and I'm glad we met, and it just fires me up to connect with you again, Joe. Joe Williams is the director of the Greenwich Library, which has consistently set the standard of excellence with its large collections, extensive programs, and record-breaking attendance numbers. It's recognized and respected as a model for libraries nationwide, and as the number one most visited library in Connecticut. Greenwich Library exemplifies how libraries are defining their roles in the 21st century, in this case with the recent injection of $5 million thanks to the Lynn and Richard Pasquilano family. This $5 million endowment will help the Greenwich Library continue to be a premier library, not just here in Connecticut, but for our entire nation. So, Joe, thank you so much for your leadership, and we can't wait to talk to you again. Well, we are back in the midpoint here on For the People with an organization that I explained to our trio of guests this morning has quickly become a premier guest here on the award-winning For the People. I'm talking about Impact Fairfield County. It was founded back in 2015 and is based on the Impact 100 model of collective giving. The goal was to gather at least 100 women in the area to pool their contributions to make significant philanthropic investments in local nonprofits, and boom, $2.1 million later, they are still rolling and better than ever before. We're going to hear all about what this organization does and how they do it, how they're expanding beyond just providing vetting and providing grants to very important public activities. And we are pleased to have their co-presidents with us, Kristen Rosenbaum and Annika Kennan, as well as their vice president, Jennifer Servideo, to talk about it. But first, we want to put out the call to all 6th to 12th graders within the sound of our voice. We want you to join 100 Black Men of Stamford Incorporated as they engage the community through innovation and education on May 31st at their free second annual STEM Fest. This is an all-day interactive event with exciting workshops and activities that aims to deliver fun, learning, and connections, and it's all happening at the Co-Create space on John Street in Stamford. There's even going to be a breakout STEM 101 for Parents session supported by Ethnic Online Foundation. So get in on all the activities by registering or learn more about 100 Black Men of Stamford and their second annual STEM Fest by visiting 100bmos.com. That's the number 100bmos.com. Sounds like a great event, huh, guys?
Yeah. Yes, it does.
Yes. Not in any way to overshadow your latest great event, which was this second impactful conversation that you recently held entitled Gaining Space for Mental Wellness. We'll be talking a little bit about that with Jennifer Servideo in just a few moments. But first, let me go to you, Kristen, beyond that humble introduction. Give us a little bit more sense of the history and scope of Impact Fairfield County.
Thanks, John, and thanks for the nice introduction. It's great to speak with you again. As you mentioned, Impact's been around for, this is our 10th year, working with nonprofits across Fairfield County. So we are a women's collective giving organization. And what we do is we amplify donations that are made in two nonprofits in Fairfield County by each woman donating $1,000, and we pool that together to make $100,000 grants. So this year, we have 287 members, so we will be able to donate $287,000. And we have a pretty extensive application process where we review. This year, we had almost 60 applicants, and we'll end up with six. And from that six, our members will get to vote for the two who win $100,000, and then the four runner-ups will share the remaining funds.
Great. So how do you recruit or find members or over this 10-year period of activity? Has your reputation grown so large that folks are actually coming to you or perhaps even waitlisted to be part of Impact Fairfield County?
That's a great question. No, there's absolutely no wait list. The more members that we have, the more funds that we can give away. So we grew to a little over 100 members our first year back in 2015. And now, as I mentioned, we're over 280 members and still growing. So the way we reach people is really through word of mouth. People have a great experience being a member with us. They tell their friends, they bring their friends the following year. And that's where we had most of our success. Of course, we have social media and we have our website. And as you mentioned, Impact 100 is a national organization that we based our model off of. So people who move to the area may have heard of us and seek us out. And but really, it's word of mouth. That's really how we get most of our members.
Very good. So part of this 10th year is reflecting and memorializing past Impact winners with these Impact videos that you're producing?
Yes, John.
That's correct. I'll let Annika.
Yeah. I can share a little bit about this. So we are trying to honor all our past grantees. So we have 17 grantees to date, and we wanted to highlight them in this process and during this 10th anniversary year. We started out this fall with creating what we call Flashback Fridays. So every Friday we would have an overview over what did they do with the Impact Grant, what was it about, and what are some of the outcomes and some of their future plans. We moved on to now in January, we worked together with Sacred Heart Greenwich, the high school students there, and one of their film classes who have created social media videos for each of our grantees. And it's been a really positive experience connecting the nonprofits in Fairfield County that are our previous grantees with the students at Sacred Heart. And they have made some really amazing videos that are just about to be launched, and we have a press release coming out, and we will be launching it on our website. Sacred Heart is doing the same, and we are hoping that all our grantees will respond really positively to these videos.
Great. Well, before we go to Jennifer to start talking a little bit more deeply about this second impactful conversation that you recently had on this incredibly important topic, let's just quickly reflect on the latest recipients of the philanthropy of Impact Fairfield County, to the extent of, you know, just letting us know who these latest nonprofit recipients are.
Sure, we can. Let's take turns. This is Kristen Rosenbaum, and I'll talk about the Boys and Girls Club of Stamford. They won a. They were awarded a $100,000 grant from throughout our process last year, and the project was to provide mental health kind of first aid response training to their staff. So the kids that they have that come, the thousands of kids that come to the Boys and Girls Club at Stamford every day. Many have traumatic experiences that they face, and the staff was noticing that they didn't have the right tools to deal with that and to make sure that they could de-escalate situations or find these kids people to talk to. So they've actually been going through training this year, and they've trained over 70 people already. So that's our grant is funding that training. And then I'll let Annika talk about the next one.
Yep. So this is Annika. I'll talk a little bit about our other grantee from last year, which was Filling in the Blanks. So Filling in the Blanks has historically been providing weekend meal packages for students in Norwalk and a few other surrounding communities. And they proposed to us that they would launch a fresh food on the move, mobile food pantry, because they were learning that the food provided for the children was actually being shared with their families over the weekends. So they have pulled together these mobile food pantries where not only are they providing food, they're also providing other services and connecting the attendees with various other nonprofit organizations, such as flu shots or COVID vaccines or other health checks and kind of financial wellness connections as well. So that has been a really successful program, and they've been able to provide a lot of food to their attendees, including fresh food, which is a big step up.
Yeah, Filling in the Blanks, a fairly recent addition to our massive For the People family of nonprofits. And what an impressive interview that we had with their folks and the work they're doing. So worthy of your support at Impact Fairfield County as and ours here at Connoisseur Media. Just a spectacular group. So these were the two latest recipients.
Sure. Jen, do you want to go and talk about CE or Catholic Academy?
Sure. So the prior year, our two grantees, the first was the Catholic Academy of Bridgeport, and they were awarded a grant to their St. Raphael Academy to create the Happy Hollow Outdoor Learning Center, which is a multi-use outdoor area for the children to play and learn. And they're seeing incredible results since this has been built in that they are saving 45 minutes in their weeks before they used to have to transport their kids for PE classes. But now they can do things on site. And they are also now starting to incorporate science lessons in this outdoor area. And they're even seeing great behavioral changes from their kids. That same year, the Center for Empowerment and Education was also our finalist, and they were awarded to start their campus advocacy, prevention, education, and training program. So this really, what CEE does is they work with victims of interpersonal violence and provide support services in counseling and advocacy and intervention, but they also work towards prevention. So this allowed them to launch a pilot program in a couple of schools where they were able to go into the schools three times annually. And what they saw from that was that the longer engagements really provided an opportunity for ongoing reinforcement of concepts and for trust and the ability to track progress, continued support. And now they're seeing that more schools are expressing an interest in participating in these programs with them.
Well, like staying within the tradition of supporting in part organizations that are tied to enhancing and improving the lives of young people, Impact Fairfield County hosted this second impactful conversation recently called Gaining Space for Mental Wellness. So, Jennifer, while we have you on the microphone, I understand to some extent this was your baby or your project. Along with all of your support colleagues. Tell us a little bit more about it, and we'll start with you, but I wanted to get each of your reactions or things that you took away to it that you might want to articulate to folks that are listening who may not have been able to attend, but who might benefit from that snippet of information. So Jennifer, tee us up here about what it was all about and what you took away from it.
Absolutely. Thank you. So our impactful conversations that we host twice a year are really opportunities to educate our members and friends. Members are welcome to bring friends about the issues that we're seeing happening in Fairfield County. In the past, we have covered topics from food and housing insecurity to the changing needs in education. And most recently, we've been seeing a lot of issues around mental health and wellness and how we can offer education and support in this area. So we were really lucky to have three incredible panelists, Dr. Dylan Coleman, who is a psychologist and the author of Resolving the Anxiety Dilemma, along with Dr. Gail Melanson, who's the executive director of Mid-Fairfield Community Care Center, and Jessica Hirsch, who is the executive director of OK to Delay. One of our impact board members was the moderator for this panel. And we really had an opportunity to talk about technology and isolation and how these affect both adults and children, and how we're seeing changes in mental health due to isolation. But then we were even able to go a little further and talk about things that we can do for ourselves, for our children, you know, as simple as, you know, putting our phones down during meals, or really having transparent and honest conversations with our kids about what's okay and what's not okay when it comes to technology and how and when we're using it, and making sure that we are also keeping live interactions with each other. We talked a lot about the importance of community and continuing to build community.
How about you, Annika? What was your takeaway from this event?
Yeah, I think Jen did a really good job summing it up. But I think one of the things that, you know, we really can, that was highlighted was that this really hits all different communities. It doesn't matter if you're a student, if you're an adult, young children, if you're under-resourced or if you are not, it really affects all our communities. And it's something that we really need to, you know, keep having a conversation about. And it's not something that's going to be a one fix. It's a continuous conversation. And as technology changes and as our lives are being impacted by social media, now AI is coming, there's just, you know, you have to try to be a step ahead, but it's a challenge.
Very good. Kristen, how about you a minute or so on your feelings after hearing this incredible panel?
I think what hit me hardest was when Gail Melanson from Mid-Fairfield Community Care Center told us that the level of mental health needs that she's seen since she's been at this organization has just, you know, grown in huge amounts. She was saying that children as young as 8 and 10 years old are having suicidal thoughts. They don't have enough therapists to meet the demand, and it's just so sad. And of course, this is not all attributed to technology, but in large part, it is. These kids are spending a lot of time alone as opposed to with friends. And I think, you know, when you have the world at your fingertips, so you just tend to sit in a room alone and use it instead of interacting and going outside. And I think that makes a big difference. But it was frightening to hear the numbers when she was talking about it.
Well, I appreciate your all of your insights into reflecting on this activity. But let's turn our attention in the last minute or two that we have with you to a big future activity, and that is the grant celebration in May. Kristen, we'll give you the last word, and just let folks know all about that, and we will say farewell for now.
We are really looking forward to our grant award celebration. It's going to be very special this year as we celebrate our 10th anniversary. We will have, in addition to awarding our grants this year, of which we will have two $100,000 grants and then six runner-ups who will each receive a smaller operating grant, we will also have all 17 of our past grantees there to mingle with our members, give an update to all of us on what they've been doing since they were awarded their grant, let us know how the project we funded ended up. So I think it's going to be extra special this year. So it's May 7th at the Woodway Country Club, as you mentioned. And yeah, it should be a great way to end our year, our 10th year.
And we'll send people to the website for information and tickets.
Yes, tickets is free and all are welcome. You don't need to be a member to come. So we hope to see many new faces there.
Very good. I want to thank our guests this morning, Jennifer Servideo, who is vice president, and co-presidents, Annika Kennan and Kristen Rosenbaum, who's been on our program before. They're all representing Impact Fairfield County, a collective giving organization whose mission is to empower women to engage in local philanthropy through deeper knowledge and active participation in grant making. If you'd like to join them, if you'd like to support them or attend one or more of their upcoming events, it all starts with the information you get at their website, simply impactffc.org. Thank you all today for the conversation, and we can't wait to talk again. Thanks, guys. Well, as we promised in our introduction, we have welcomed back Sarah Eisley-Derley from the Connecticut Data Collaborative. They've got some breaking news about a new report that they just issued, and we just wanted to catch up with Sarah to remind people about this important organization here in Connecticut, this 501c3 nonprofit that's connecting people and data to promote informed decision making and to advance equity in Connecticut. Sarah, I can't imagine a time when data could be more important or engaging, especially when we see so much of it being taken away or obfuscated in some ways. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Before we get into the conversation, though, I wanted to call on anyone listening to make a difference in a child's life. The New Haven Tutoring Initiative is looking for passionate volunteers to join them in supporting and advancing the next generations of community leaders. Whether you have just an hour or a few to spare every week, your support can help bridge the learning gap for students in the community. The Tutoring Initiative is supported by the United Way of Greater New Haven and other community partners and provides opportunities for students to learn critical reading and math skills, to build home libraries, and develop an enjoyment of reading and math. You can sign up today and help create brighter futures. Learn more by visiting the United Way of Greater New Haven and their tutoring initiative page, uwgnh.org/tutoring. All right. Sarah, how have you been? It's been almost a year since we talked. How are things going at the Connecticut Data Collaborative?
Yeah, they're going well. We are doing a lot of workshops and analysis, trying to find ways to connect people and gather people together while also finding ways that we can contribute to the important conversations that are happening in our state.
I don't want to in any way slosh over into political conversation, but I know that you and your team had some very interesting, if not intense, a few weeks there, a couple of months ago, as a number of the sources that your team goes to help build the data sets and do the work that you do, suddenly were either threatened with disappearing or were suddenly not available or taken offline. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did. It didn't really make headline news, but among data people for the past few weeks, there's been a lot of collaboration and identifying who has what data sets just in case they go missing. There's very little transparency about what was going to be down permanently. And then of those data sets that did go down and then came back up, we actually don't know if things were changed about them or if they were the same. But CT Data downloaded and made sure that we would have access to over 1,000 data sets that we kind of use on a regular basis. And there's many other efforts, libraries and other public institutions that have sought to make sure that they have their own data sets in case that happens again.
Very good. So as you're moving forward, you and like-minded individuals and organizations across the country are quickly, you know, kind of going on the offense, really. And, you know, it's like protecting the fine works of art in wartime to some extent from a data perspective, right?
Certainly. I mean, and you know, the point of data and the point of the Census Bureau even collecting data to begin with is to make sure that businesses and communities have decisions to ensure that their communities can thrive, that they can make decisions about, you know, locations of business and how they want to attract business or what the population is changing, so how they need to invest in schools or pull back on certain investments. Without this data, communities would be blind in terms of what information they would have at their fingertips to make these important decisions. And we would waste a whole lot more money than we, you know, may already do now.
Very good. So the breaking news, as we mentioned earlier, is the release just in the past few days, as we're recording this here on February 27th, of a new analysis called New Federal DOT Policy Would Disadvantage Connecticut, Especially Our Urban Centers. What's that about?
Well, we, of course, were interested in the policy change by the Department of Transportation to focus their investments primarily on communities where there was a higher than average birth rate and or marriage rate. It's not exactly clear which or both would be the priority. And, you know, the Urban Institute put out this analysis and we thought this is really interesting. What does this look like for Connecticut? We should have this in Connecticut to help us understand how would we be impacted by this policy. And of course, the headline says Connecticut would be disadvantaged. Our birth rate is lowest, almost the lowest in the country. We are 46 out of 52 states, and our marriage rate is 26th. Out of the 52, you know, states plus D.C. and Puerto Rico. So we are under the national average on both of those elements. And when we looked even further at communities where there were people without a car, you know, of course, transportation funding, it helps us build bridges and roads and maintain those things, which are really important. But it also goes to ensure that we have robust transportation and, you know, things like sidewalks and things like that in more populated areas. And of course, what we found, not surprisingly, was that there is lower car ownership in census tracts, which is a geography we look at for data. There's just lower car ownership, or I'm sorry, there's higher car ownership in the areas that have higher birth rates and marriage rates. So this funding would disadvantage cities, which if you've ever walked in a city or try to use public transportation in Connecticut cities, it really struggles. And so it would mean people who already have a hard time getting to work and earning a living would possibly have even harder times making ends meet and supporting their families, which is what, you know, we want. We want to make sure that families are able to thrive and be supported and be healthy. And this transportation policy may, in fact, have the opposite effect on families in Connecticut.
So people are more interested in reading this report and learning more about it. They could just go to ctdata.org at your website?
Yes.
Very good. The Connecticut Data Collaborative is engaged in a variety of different events and activities that touch our lives every year, at least for all of those who had interest in or headed to the polls to vote last November. The Data Collaborative provided a very comprehensive analysis of the 2024 election turnout, something I know you're particularly proud of, Sarah, right?
Yes, I am. I've been very involved with this project. We've done a lot of different analysis and we'll continue to do analysis on this data, looking at some Hartford neighborhoods and how those you know, have changed, and hopefully there's been some increases in turnout and engagement. But across the board, the analysis of the 24 election, we saw some news headlines that were somewhat anecdotal. They were seeing that there were more communities that were closer in the race between the Republican and the Democratic presidential nominee. And there were just some questions that we just decided, like, let's look at the data to see what the data says. And the initial data that was put out by the Secretary of State found that there's been declining voter turnout in the past three elections, and that there were actually 14 towns in Connecticut that voted Democratic in the last election and went Republican in this election. So just a lot of really interesting stuff going on that people involved in voting and get out the vote and educating voters, we thought that this would be really useful information as they think about their local elections happening this year.
So versus picking up what they think is fact over the virtual back fence of a social network, they can just go to ctdata.org to get the real facts on election turnout here in the state of Connecticut. A great service that's provided by the Connecticut Data Collaborative. At the same time, I know when I worked much more closely with or in nonprofits, we were at a point where outcome reporting was the most critically important to show how the donated dollars and operational dollars were working. But today, being able to amass and utilize data as part of strategic planning is something that the Connecticut Data Collaborative has really put their shoulder into to benefit now dozens and dozens of nonprofits across the state. Let's hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, we started a service that we call Data Strategic Planning, and we created it because we noticed, you know, we provide workshops, we host conference and other kind of data meetups for people who are data minded. And there was this gap in people really being able to apply some of the ideas that we were talking about, and people feeling a little overwhelmed when they got back to their organizations and tried to figure out how to make these changes with data. So much about data really is about culture and about helping people talk about data and get on the same page about what do we even mean when we say the word data. So we created Data Strategic Planning as a way to work really intensively with nonprofits so that they could be strategic in the data that they are collecting. So the data they're collecting is worthwhile, so that the data they're collecting really can help them understand how to make better informed decisions for their organizations and related to what you're saying, to be better able to show the outcomes of their work. So it's helping have better quality information to understand if we are having the outcomes that we intend.
And if you weren't part of one of these 75 nonprofits that have been helped to date by the Connecticut Data Collaborative, they still want to help you, and that's where the Connecticut Data Academy comes in. It's for everybody, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. I mean, we really pride ourselves on being unconventional data people. You know, I have a background in a Bachelor of Arts degree from undergraduate school, and I'm a musician, and people like me are data people. We have the power to learn how to use data effectively, again, to make the important decisions for our organizations and also our communities, just as citizens and residents of the state. So our workshops are for people who are new to data, as well as people who do have more skills. And we include topics such as designing forms and surveys. Intake forms are often an overlooked piece of data in our planning in our organization. So we provide workshops in that topic, in data storytelling, and then also in analyzing numbers or quantitative data, as well as other kinds of workshops. We also do customize workshops for organizations so that if, you know, an organization has a team that really is trying to increase their skills together, we can customize workshops with their data. And we love doing that. That's always really exciting. And we're actually trying to be more strategic in offering our workshops more across the state. We did a strategic planning process a couple of years ago, and people said, we want more workshops in other parts of the state other than Hartford, you know, where we're located and where we've had offices. So we're offering some workshops in London area. We will be offering some workshops in the Waterbury area and hopefully in the Norwalk, Fairfield County area again this year. So we're trying to make sure that it's really accessible to people. And we also do offer some virtual events as well that people can learn about on our website too.
And if folks, if you don't go to the folks can come to your annual conference, which is in the planning stages now. But each year it hosts over 200 people from across the entire state, both folks who are deeply drilled into utilizing or developing data, as well as fledglings who are getting ready to begin to immerse themselves in how to do it, how to use it, how to understand it, right?
That's right. Yep. And we offer it in the fall. So this year we're narrowing down the date, but it will be in likely in October of this year. And we pride ourselves again on being an event where people can come to actually get to know other people. It's hard to do this data work on your own. You can learn a lot of skills by using tools that you find online, you know, tutorials online. But when it comes down to it, like we are people, we are humans, we need to bring critical thinking and ethics into this work. And by being connected with other humans in this work, we can make sure that we're, you know, learning new ideas, integrating new concepts, integrating ethics in ways that are realistic in the work that we're doing, and really just connecting with other people and remembering that the work that we do is not just to crunch numbers, but it's really to support the flourishing of everyone in Connecticut.
Sarah Isley-Durley is our go-to for the people data guru, representing the Connecticut Data Collaborative, which is seeking to support informed decision-making across Connecticut by equipping and empowering regular people like me to access and use data. Sarah, very much appreciate the information this morning. If you'd like to read this new report that they just issued, new federal DOT policy would disadvantage Connecticut, especially our urban centers. You can read that and learn all about their activities and resources at their website, simply ctdata.org. Sarah, thank you very much for your time this morning, and we'll talk to you again. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.